for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Modern economic theory has been based in large part on the notion that prices in financial markets can and do take all known risks into account. But in the months leading up to the current financial crisis, this faith in market rationality was clearly misplaced. Time magazine economics correspondent Justin Fox describes how the theory of rational markets developed and what's at risk when this theory is widely accepted by policymakers and financial leaders. His new book on the subject is titled The Myth of the Rational Market, A History of Risk, Reward, and Delusion on Wall Street. Justin Fox joins me in the studio. I look forward to hearing your thoughts. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Justin. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Explain this rational market theory.
In its simplest form, it's the idea that the prices in financial markets are right, that they sift through all the information, all the millions of investors out there sift through all the information, make a balanced assessment of all the possible risks, and to a certain extent, balance out the obvious irrationalities of lots of individual investors. But that somehow, even though you're not requiring every individual to be perfectly smart and rational, the market as a whole aggregates it in this way that delivers you correct prices.
And this whole theory goes back to about 1905.
That's how I sketch it in the book. You can find antecedents going back a couple centuries before, but they were never as rigorous and never as extreme. And the figure I start with is Irving Fisher, who was really the first great American economist. And he was also he was a great economist, but he was also a fool on certain matters. And he's best known today still for having declared repeatedly in the summer and early fall of 1929 that stock prices had reached a permanently high plateau. And they hadn't.
And we know what happened then. Well, what happened this time?
As I tell it in the story, I think a lot of people, most of them not as nutty as Irving Fisher, and most of them smart enough not to say anything about stock prices reaching a permanently high plateau, although a couple people did write a book in 1999 or 2000 called Dow 36,000, which was based on these financial theories. But they came up, sort of resurrected these ideas of Fisher's, put them in more extreme form, but also more careful form. And they did it for good reasons. These models, these views of how the world works are very useful for certain purposes. But as the ideas kind of sifted out into society, into the corporate world and elsewhere, I think they caused us to make some pretty wrong assumptions about how secure we were in our current financial market
system. So what you're suggesting is that policymakers, financial leaders, those who had the influence were still relying on this rational market theory in making the decisions that led up to the fall of the market back in 2008.
Right. And what's fascinating is starting in the early 80s in economics departments and business school finance departments at universities, these ideas were starting to come under attack. It was a pretty by the mid 90s, you'd have to say, among the younger generation of scholars, it was pretty well established that no, you can't markets have bubbles. They go crazy. They're very useful. They're very good at sussing out the relative price of two different companies versus each other, but they're not. They clearly go through waves. And people like Robert Shiller, the Yale economist, and even Larry Summers, who now runs our economy from the White House, were these rebels in the 80s pointing this out, which basically pointing out that the emperor had no clothes. Yet, because they didn't have any really clear replacement theory to offer that explained everything so perfectly as rational market theory does, and because everything seemed to be working quite well through the 90s, the standard policy stance was, okay, we'll let the market figure it out.
And would you consider Alan Greenspan to have been one of those?
Definitely.
Here's what he had to say in October of 2008.
Remember that what an ideology is, it's a conceptual framework with the way people deal with reality. Everyone has one. You have to exist, you need an ideology. The question is whether it is accurate or not. And what I'm saying to you is, yes, I found a flaw. I don't know how significant or permanent it is, but I've been very distressed by that fact. But if I may I just finish an answer to the question previously?
You found a flaw in the reality?
A flaw in the model that I perceived is the critical functioning structure that defines how the world works, so to speak.
In other words, you found that your view of the world, your ideology, was not right. It was not working.
Precisely. No, that's precisely the reason I was shocked, because I've been going for 40 years or more with very considerable evidence that it was working exceptionally well.
And, of course, that was former Fed Chair Alan Greenspan talking with California Congressman Waxman. Was he at that very moment repudiating the whole theory of the rational market?
No, he was saying it clearly didn't work under all circumstances. And one thing I've got to say is, when I read the transcript of that hearing, for whatever reason, I didn't watch it when it happened. I guess because I had no idea Greenspan would say that. I just remember thinking, oh, he wrote my introduction for me. Thank you so much, Chairman. And the funny thing about Greenspan is that he combined an actually pretty flexible and heterodox view of economics with his sort of Ayn Rand libertarian background.
Leave it alone. It'll take care of itself.
So he believed there were bubbles. He didn't think the market was right all the time, but he figured everything would work out. And he also, he had this kind of defining experience in late 96, where the stock market had been on this upward roll for 6 months. Well, it had been for several years, but it had then really taken off that summer. And he got up and made a speech wondering if maybe irrational exuberance were at work. And for a day or two, markets around the world fell, and then they just took off and started rising again. And the lesson he took from that, he writes about it in his memoirs, is, I'm not smarter than the market. I need to just stop doing that. And it's sort of tragic, because in the sense that's true. That was sort of this humble statement, but it led him then. And you read Greenspan's speeches in 2003, 2004, 2005, he would outline the risks. He knew he was studying what was going on in the housing market and all the equity that people were extracting from their homes. And he would sort of half raise these alarms and then always
back
off. The market knows what it's doing.
Justin Fox, his new book is titled The Myth of the Rational Market, A History of Risk, Reward, and Delusion on Wall Street. Justin Fox is the business and economics columnist for Time magazine and the author of Time.com blog, The Curious Capitalist. I do invite your calls, 800-433-8850. Tell me this, Justin. If Alan Greenspan had put aside that faith in his studies of the prior 40 years and stepped in, what could he have done, number one? And number two, could he have prevented what happened next?
Well, what he had the power to do as chairman of the Fed, the whole Federal Reserve Board would have had to vote to do this, was do something to rein in the practices going on in the mortgage market. Because last year, Ben Bernanke and the Fed passed a set of rules. They already had the legal authority through the Truth in Lending law and maybe some other laws to set basic rules for mortgage lending. And the Fed now has rules in place that would have made most of the crazy mortgage loans of 2002 through 2006 illegal. And so he definitely had the power to do that. One of the issues, and there was sort of this other academic sub-movement that merged very well with the rational market people, and it was the school of public choice, and it was the study of how regulators behave and the fact that regulators aren't these perfect, impartial beings. They're flawed. They try to advance their own personal and organizational agendas. And I think Greenspan was a big believer in that and therefore incredibly dubious of regulation. And so that's where, I mean, Ned Gramlich, one of the Fed board members, had actually come to Greenspan. I can't remember if it was 2003, 2004. And Gramlich had been a big backer of subprime lending early on as a way to extend credit to more people. But he sort of raised the alarm and said, this is getting out of control. We need to do something. And Greenspan just was not. He didn't give an absolute no, but he just said, that's not something I'm interested in. So, yes, Greenspan had the authority to do something. I will say, if he'd tried in 2004 to do this big crackdown that would have put a whole bunch of mortgage lenders out of business, Congress wouldn't have been real happy about it. I mean, and that's the difficulty. Beyond all these theories and the economists, there's just something about society when it's in a financial boom that it's really difficult to be on the side of telling everybody to stop.
Justin Fox, his new book is titled The Myth of the Rational Market. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. And we're back with Time Magazine economics correspondent Justin Fox. His new book, titled The Myth of the Rational Market, explores what he calls a history of risk, reward, and delusion on Wall Street. I want to go back to what you were saying a little earlier, that one of the Federal Bank Board members had come to Alan Greenspan and expressed concern about what was happening in the housing market. And as you reported, Alan Greenspan said, I'm not interested in that. My question is, does the chair have total authority? Why is there a bank board if the chairman can simply say, I'm not interested in that because my theory is thus and such, and thereby dismiss concerns?
Formally, no, the chairman can't stop things. But I think the way the Fed worked under Greenspan, and I don't think this was any, you know, jackbooted thug kind of thing. It was just he was a very astute political maneuverer. He was the driving force. Things had to go through him. He would delegate certain areas to certain other to members of the Federal Reserve Board. But it was just, I mean, and I think I can't remember the exact story because Greenspan has talked about this since. Gramlich, who brought it up in the first place, has since died. And Greenspan says, well, clearly Ned's recollections are probably correct, but I wouldn't have stopped him if he'd really wanted to push that. But I think the reality of the way the Fed worked, under Greenspan at least, was that you didn't push things that the chairman didn't want. Bernanke has done a lot of talk about having a more collegial Fed. But I will say one of the reasons why we now have this Fed where the chairman plays a dominant role is the way the Fed was set up until the early 30s was much more diffuse, and especially the regional bank presidents had much more independent power. And the feeling was in the early 30s, it completely broke down because there was no dominant figure and nobody could agree on what to do. And therefore, we got the Great Depression.
Justin, here's an email from Ross in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He says, how did Ayn Rand become so influential in the market, in the free market ideologues, on the free market ideologues, and who among them were most seduced?
Well, it's interesting because among economists, at least the ones at the University of Chicago who play a really crucial role in this story, most of them, the book that got them going was not Ayn Rand. It wasn't The Fountainhead. It was Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom. And both of those books came out in the early to mid-40s. And I think what it was they were perceived as such a breath of something fresh and new and different, because the kind of old conservative thinkers had been seemingly utterly discredited, conservative economic thinkers, had been seemingly utterly discredited by the Depression and what had happened. And definitely in American intellectual life, I mean, there's that famous line, this was from the early 50s, Lionel Trilling, saying, you know, there is no other American intellectual tradition but the liberal one. Everything else has died out. And this was actually a couple of years after it had started to come back with those books. But in the story I tell in the book, you realize that intellectual movements come about very often because as a reaction to the excesses of the previous intellectual regime. And so we're going to get that now in reaction to this sort of rationalist economics. But these guys came up with these ideas because the standard American intellectual worldview through the 50s really was that financial markets weren't useful or rational, and there wasn't real competition in American economic life. And so these people were all reacting to that probably overdone worldview.
Here's another email from Steve in Baltimore, who says George Soros has made billions from his belief that the efficient market theory is wrong. Specifically, he uses the term reflexivity for his belief that false perception creates feedback loops that affect markets. A good example of this is the periodic bubbles, where false perception causes people to invest simply because others are investing, thus driving up prices beyond all reality until the bubbles burst.
Well, and Soros is absolutely right, and people are paying a lot more attention to this general idea now that the whole idea of this rational market version of economics, and even a lot of the people who object to it on the fringes and think, yes, there are inefficiencies, is still that what markets are about is financial markets are trying to come up with a reflection of fundamentals, of reality. What Soros is saying that, well, yeah, they try to do that, but they're very frequently you come across things where what happens in the markets drives reality, that it's the markets that are determining the fundamentals. And once you start thinking about that, you realize that you can never completely get your hands on what the market is all about. It does both. It tries to reflect reality, but it also influences reality.
Of course, in the current situation, what also came about were new instruments people really didn't understand.
And that is a pretty common to every financial bubble and crash is financial innovation. Something new comes along, it seems great, and it's never been tested by adversity. And I mean, it's amazing that we do this again and again, but it's just that's what happens. It hasn't been tested by adversity, so people haven't come up with rules of thumb about how to use these things.
So these credit default swaps, for example.
Right. And I mean, one of the issues with the current financial crisis is we're all still, and this may take decades, I mean, people are still arguing about the causes of the Great Depression. So it's not clear at all what role they played in it, what role the whole Washington push towards home ownership played in it. Somehow it was this toxic brew of all of it. And I guess what always turns a bubble and crash, which can happen sometimes without huge bad economic effects, is if people borrowed lots of money based on those rising asset values, then you get this real difficulty because suddenly houses are worth half of what they were a couple years ago, and all these people who borrowed money based on the initial value of the house, you have a financial crisis.
You talk in the book about the tension that developed between the so-called random walkers and those who study price charts. Tell us more about that.
Well, that's what, I mean, this intellectual movement that really arose starting in the 1950s, and it echoed things that have been said before, but it really arose as this all-conquering movement. It started with people sort of investigating the claims of those who thought they could read the future in past price charts. And their argument was simply, well, if that were true, then everybody would suddenly rush to take advantage of these things and they would go away, which is a very logical argument. And the other part of it was that you could, using purely random processes, create charts that seem to have all sorts of great patterns in them. And I mean, what's funny is even that, and it's all, that's all pretty sensible, and there's a lot of truth to it, although over the past 10, 15 years, a lot of finance scholars have realized that a lot of these things the chartists do. I mean, the most common thing that chart reading people do is believe that trends continue. And that's, finance scholars have figured out that, oh yeah, trends continue until they stop. I mean, that's the difficulty with making money off it. But markets have momentum. Once things get started in a particular direction, they keep going in that direction for a while.
So you had even people like Wall Street Journal's editor, Peter Hamilton, believing that the stock market predicted the economy and not the other way around.
Right. He was, William Peter Hamilton was the guy who made Dow theory famous, and that's kind of the original chart reading theory of how the market works. And I mean, Hamilton didn't make really outrageous claims. His claim was really that the market goes in these bull periods and bear periods, and when it's in a bear period, you don't want to be buying stocks. And so his service that he tried to provide was tell people what the market was in, a bull wave or a bear one.
But here's the question for the current situation. Going back to 1929 and looking at the comparison with what began last fall, how much of a role did fraud play in either or both situations?
Well, I think when people start being willing to pay crazy amounts for financial assets, be they stocks in the 20s, stocks in the late 1990s, houses in the last few years, there's the temptation to scam them are huge. And so I think, especially with the housing bubble, a lot of it wasn't fraud in the formal legal sense, although I guess that's going to be tested over the next couple of years. I think the Justice Department is going to start trying to charge these investment banks and others. But it was sort of this mass delusion more than common fraud.
Mass delusion.
Yes. I just think we do that to ourselves from time to time because the people who are skeptics are made to look dumb. Because they say, oh, this can't go on. This is going to end any minute. You know, I don't want to – I'm going to rent. I'm not going to get into this housing market. And then their next-door neighbor, you know, doubles their money and flips their house and moves to Las Vegas. And the skeptic looks like an idiot.
So what is the bottom line message you want to send to readers from your book?
I mean, I would say the most important one is that – there is no one model or theory for how the market works. There is no simple, hard and fast rule that gets you to the right investing strategy or the right regulatory strategy all the time. It you have to have this sense that there is an awful lot of information and rational judgment in prices, but sometimes there's not. And one thing that happens is as we convince ourselves that the world is one way or the other, it moves in the other direction. I mean, that's the difficulty with economic theories, and especially financial theories, is it's this attempt to make scientific theories about the world, but you come up with a theory in physics and it doesn't necessarily change physical behavior. Whereas you come up with a theory of how markets work and how you should invest, if everybody comes around to it, and there's been a lot of talk lately about sort of asset allocation and diversification having been made popular by these finance professors through the years. Once everybody's doing it and doing it the same way, it stops working.
So what's your message?
Life's complicated. And I think, I mean, it's clear that there's a lot to be said for being contrarian. It's just, and that's one of the great truths that I think everybody in academic finance is coming around to over the past decade or two, is that people who buy stuff that's cheap do better over the long run than those who pay more.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. That's quite a message, Justin. We're going to open the phones now. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. First to Brian in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane and Justin. My question, first, my bias. I'm a free market guy, and I would argue that that our quality of life is better than it was 50 years ago. So if that's my bias, excuse me, I'm a little nervous.
Oh, don't be. It's okay. Go right ahead.
I'm not an economist, but I've heard Milton Friedman be maligned since the fallout a year or so ago. And I've heard the former Fed chairman be apologetic about his decisions. But at the end of the day, if we're trying to achieve a better quality of life in America, we have to realize that any economic system has its pains. I'd just rather have growing pains than other kinds. And so here's my question, isn't the market behaving efficiently and in the long term beneficially in a free market where we've got the flexibility to make our adjustments as the pain comes?
I would say, yeah, for the most part. And I think the greatest evidence for free markets is not these theories of how rational markets are. It's just comparing places that have freer market systems with those that don't. Although, I mean, I will say, so it's pretty clear that the old Soviet style of economic governance doesn't work at all. It's not so clear that different varieties of social democracy don't function. There's really, I think, a lot of people. The economic data in the late 1990s seemed to show the U.S. doing much better than Western Europe. And as time has passed, that's much less convincing now. And I love Milton Friedman. I interviewed him a couple times for the book, and I disagree with him on some things. But what Milton Friedman was about in the end was liberty. And it was sort of bringing the idea that personal liberty was partly also economic liberty. I think he misunderstood a lot of, well, I don't know, misunderstood. I think he oversold things a bit. And there is some sense where the liberty of large corporations isn't necessarily conducive to the liberty of individuals. And that's why we have governments. That's why we have regulations. So I guess in the end, yeah, free markets are great, and especially free markets in things other than financial instruments don't have these bubble problems. But there's clearly something about financial markets that is unstable. And that doesn't mean we have to kill off the instability, but we have to be aware of that and structure our society that it can handle.
But, you know, at some point we have to talk about what you write in the book, the difference between market unpredictability and true randomness. You give some good examples in the book.
Well, what it is there was this discovery or rediscovery in the late 50s, early 60s, that market movements seem to be pretty random. And interestingly, in the very beginning, it was this very free-flowing movement, and there was this mathematician at IBM, Benoit Mandelbrot, was from a Polish Jew who had grown up in hiding in France during World War II and somehow ended up with, well, he ended up in it because he was brilliant, in this great job at IBM where he could just do whatever math he wanted and noodle around with things. And he had become interested in the patterns in financial market movements in the early 60s and started trying to build this theory of a randomness that's not the sort of randomness you get in things like, you know, patterns in people's heights, or the randomness you find in the physical world is very often, it fits under a bell curve. It's called normal randomness. And Mandelbrot was exploring all the crazy randomness of financial markets, and people were all really interested in it for a while. And then they realized, no, it was actually much easier and more useful to assume that financial markets behaved in this orderly, normal way.
Justin Fox, his new book, The Myth of the Rational Market. When we come back, we'll talk about poker strategy, World War II gunnery, and how that figures in. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Robin and Murray Sinclair, helping sustain NPR's coverage of the global economy. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org. And by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the politics of healthcare reform. The Congress, the insurance lobby, the pharmaceutical lobby, the AMA. We talk with Jonathan Cohen. He writes about healthcare politics in The New Republic and on his blog, The Treatment. He's also the author of Sick. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And here's another email for Justin Fox, the author of The Myth of the Rational Market. It comes from Phil, who says, your guest misunderstands that the rational market hypothesis does not say that markets set prices that are correct for the owners of the assets. It says markets set prices that are correct for the agents making the trades. The market performed perfectly, as proven by the fact that the traders have made more money by driving the economy into the ground than they would have by keeping it steady. Traders don't own the stocks they trade, but make their money off bonuses. They make tremendous profits if they buy a stock that goes up, but lose only their reputation if it goes down.
I mean, he's right in this. The role that agents play is really important, and it was completely ignored in finance until the 90s. I mean, there were all these theories of rational markets that were basically based on the idea that these smart professional investors would sniff out any inefficiency and make money by making it go away. And it was finally in the 90s that some people started scratching their heads and realizing, you know, people who run mutual funds, their number one goal is to stay employed and to get their paycheck every year. It's not, and that's not always compatible with the best possible market performance. The specific sort of agency problem he's describing there, where you have traders at Wall Street firms who make big money on the way up and just leave on the way down, I don't know that there's been a lot of research done on that yet. I bet there will be, given the experience of the last couple of years. Most of the research into it has been about how hard it is to be a value investor, to be like a Warren Buffett, that if you're investing other people's money, it's exactly at the time when you should be buying, like 4 months ago or 5 months ago, that it's hardest to convince your clients to keep their money with you.
He ends by saying we need the rational market hypothesis to avoid another crash. We just need to use it correctly. This means we must ensure that traders make money if their stock goes up and lose money if their stock goes down, just like the investors.
Well, good luck signing people up for employment contracts like that.
Exactly. All right. And now I want to get to this question about poker strategy and World War II gunnery. What does that have to do with rational market theory?
Well, there was this revolution in economics that came after World War II, where what had been this mostly verbal, mostly pretty diverse field, suddenly there was this rise of these mathematicians and these people who imposed this very mathematical worldview. And in my book, the two big elements in that that I identify is, one is the game theory of John von Neumann, who was this Hungarian mathematician who ended up at Princeton, was possibly the model for Dr. Strangelove. And he had just tried to come up with a theory of how you play poker rationally. And it's the actual game theory elements of it, they drifted into economics later. But the idea of sort of how you think about what is rational behavior in an uncertain situation, that came from his poker theories. It's basically this sort of mix of randomness and what the best odds are. So you have that as a starting point. The other thing that was happening is during World War II, a lot of economists, including Milton Friedman, spent the war using their statistical and mathematical skills, helping out with things like figuring out how to do the scoring on artillery shells to see how many pieces they would break into to balance risk and reward. Because basically the bigger the pieces were, the more damage they would do when they would hit. But the more pieces you had, the likelier they would hit something. So during the Battle of the Bulge, there were gunnery officers would fly back to Washington to talk to young Milton Friedman about how to do this. And so my sense was that coming out of the war, it gave these economists this confidence and this belief in these tools that they just didn't possess before at all.
All right, let's go back to the phones to Ypsilanti, Michigan. Good morning, Jacob. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I wanted to ask your guests why we so often discuss these things, and we demonize the free market without discussing the Federal Reserve's policy of regulating the value of currency through interest rates and how that subverts that same market.
Well, there have been attempts to have a true free market in money where basically people can issue their own money and anything can happen. But what we had before the Fed was a gold standard, which was just as much, it was just rule by gold, by how big gold supplies were, by what miners found in gold mines. And the thinking was, if we have this technocracy doing it, they can do a more rational job than the vagaries of the gold business in determining what our money supply is. So, at one level, it's true that the very existence of the Fed means that there's this government involvement in the very value of money. But it's not like there was some truly free market solution before there was a Fed.
Does that answer? Pardon me?
I'm sorry. I guess I have more faith in the gold market being a little less arbitrary than the interest rates set by the Federal Reserve Board.
Right. And I think the experience of the last few years, it gives gives a little more credibility to the whole idea of the gold standard. People moved away, though, from the gold standard because it caused some big problems. And I think the general consensus among economists is that it was people holding on to the gold standard that made the Great Depression this horrible global phenomenon.
Are you buying gold now, Jacob?
Yes, indeed, I am. Actually, I've been doing all of my investing in gold and silver for my entire adult life. And I stand behind the theory that gold and silver remain pretty stable, whereas the dollar has fluctuated up and down since the Federal Reserve was created.
More power to you. I mean, over my lifetime, gold has been a pretty horrible investment, but it protects you exactly at times like this.
Here's an email from Bill in Dallas, Texas. To what extent is the valuation of the U.S. dollar held hostage to the rational market theory?
Well, what happens in terms of, and we're getting back to the Federal Reserve again, I don't know if this really answers the question, but what we've had is this situation where the Fed, when times are good, just pulls back and tries to stay out of things.
Hands off.
Yeah, and then when times are bad, it jumps in and intervenes in a big way. And so it's asymmetric. They're not, and I think there's now been a lot of questioning within the Fed and elsewhere that maybe that doesn't make sense. Either you have to just let the crashes happen, but the whole reason we created the Fed was because of a bad financial crash in 1907, and they wanted to do something about it, or you make some attempt to rein things in on the way up as well.
Here's an email from Wanda. Has your guest read and watched the Rolling Stone writers Matt Taibbi's article on how Goldman Sachs has engineered every major market manipulation since the Great Depression?
I have read it. I didn't watch Matt's little video. I like the article. I mean, the basic that claim is false, that Goldman, I mean, basically he uses Goldman Sachs as this stand-in for Wall Street. And Goldman has basically been the dominant Wall Street firm for the past 15 or 20 years. And it happened, and it was not dominant. It didn't cause the Great Depression. It was just involved in this thing, these things called unit trusts that existed in the late 20s, and there's gotten a lot of trouble. So, I mean, the thesis about Goldman Sachs isn't really true, but I think he does a great job of pointing out how a mostly unregulated Wall Street works and how it's not necessarily to all of our benefit.
To John in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, good morning to you.
Yes, I have a much more sinister view of this entire thing. Historically, I mean, going back 50 years, I guess, the people that made the most money fold from, Lehman Brothers?
Lehman, yep.
Mozilla, et cetera, these people knew that they were pushing something that was going to fail. They sold before the bottom happened. And the combination of things with commodities futures, change of regulations, the interspersing of government people with Wall Street people, it just seems too dramatic to be a coincidence.
Well, I mean, I think what happens is when you let financial markets grow bigger as a part of the economy, first of all, you have this volatility, and the people who are at the helm are more able to take advantage of that volatility than you and I are. So I don't know if that's a conspiracy or not, but that's what happens. And you get incomes become more concentrated when the financial system is playing a bigger role in the economy. So, I mean, I definitely, and everybody sort of, even in the banking system, agrees that we need to have the financial sector be a smaller part of the economy. And maybe that'll happen, but I don't know that a lot of those people realize what that also means is they all should be making less money.
Well, and that brings you to the notion that politics and the health of the financial markets or the fluctuation of the financial market, how do politics relate to financial theory?
Well, and we were talking about Milton Friedman before, and I think he's a great guy in a lot of ways, but another thing he said that was he wrote this famous article for, of all places, the New York Times Sunday Magazine in, I think, 1971. And it was basically that the job of a corporation is to try to make as much money as it can. And the way he put it is, you know, their job is to try, people who run a corporation, try to increase profits as much as they can within the rules of the road, within the law. And the one problem with that whole statement, it's is that corporations influence the rules of the road and the law. And the more money they make, the more influential they can be. And you just could see that with Wall Street from when it was basically unleashed and starting in the 1970s, partly for reasons that the old way the financial system was set up was too restrictive and couldn't adjust to inflation and floating global currencies and all of that. But as Wall Street was deregulated, it made started making much more money, which gave Wall Street more power in Washington to push more regulatory changes, which allowed it to make even more money. So, and that's just a part of the whole equation that is not part of academic finance at all, that no one ever looked at. Mm. And I hope it starts getting
exactly
looked at a lot
more now. You talked about Milton Friedman. We've talked about Alan Greenspan. How did Paul Samuelson help to shape modern economic thought?
Well, Paul Samuelson, professor at MIT, and he's still during the, I guess, the summer months, actually is there in his office at MIT. He is this interesting figure because to a lot of Americans of a certain generation, his economics textbook, I think it was just called Economics, was the undergraduate economics textbook. And it was this very even-handed, wonderfully written, sort of Keynesian, middle-of-the-road economics text. So that's the public Samuelson. Samuelson, the economist, was the most brilliant, hard-nosed, mathematical economist of them all. And so a lot of these theories of the rational market, the theoretical underpinnings, came from Samuelson. Mm. And he'd write these papers, and other people would run off with him. And Samuelson would, you know, if you asked him or went to one of his lectures, would say, you know, don't read too much into any of this. I don't know if it really applies. But that's been this sort of fascinating tale of his career. And his students have been on both sides of this debate. I mean, people who were proteges of Samuelson, Robert Merton, who was a very rational market guy for most of his career and was a partner at Long-Term Capital Management on the one hand, and Joseph Stiglitz and Robert Shiller on the other.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to Boyce, Virginia. Barry, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
I'd just like to touch on something that I haven't heard at all mentioned. I don't think for my comment is I don't think we'll ever be privy to the horror that has happened to the country under the Milton Friedman philosophy. But what I wanted to say that I never have heard spoken of is the punchline is always 70% of the economy is because of consumerism. So when all the jobs are taken away and all the unions are busted and the only way people can really afford to live is to take equity out of their houses, and doesn't that clash with 70% of the economy is driven by consumerism?
Well, 70% of the economy is consumer spending. I mean, it's partly just an accounting identity. That's the rest is government and corporate investment. So all and I guess one of the things that happened is up through the early 80s, it was more like 62 or 63% of the economy was consumers. And a lot of this crisis of the last few years has been caused by the fact that we moved up to 70% being consumers, and basically people had to borrow money in order to make that work. So, I mean, you touched on so many things. I don't think I can hit all of them. But the idea, yes, consumers drive the economy, but at the same time, business and innovation are what ends up creating the incomes for those consumers. Mm. And you shouldn't shortchange either.
So considering all the research you've done, the reading, the writing, where are we right now in this very hard-hit recession?
I mean, I think we're almost out of the recession formally defined, but we're clearly in for this long, difficult period because there's just a whole lot of debt out there that isn't good debt that's not going to be able to be fully repaid.
And an awful lot of adjustment that needs to happen.
And an awful lot of people who don't have jobs and don't know where they're going to find them. The 70s were like this a little bit in a different way. It's a different kind of economic shift and adjustment. But it was this period where you'd have a recession, the economy would grow for a few years, you'd have another recession. And I'm no forecaster, but it just seems like that's what we're in for now, is this difficult period. I think in the end, we'll end up in this healthier place because we won't, I hope, be this economy totally driven by financial assets and debt.
I hope you're right.
We'll see.
Justin Fox. His new book is titled The Myth of the Rational Market, A History of Risk, Reward, and Delusion on Wall Street. Lots of theory, lots of interesting facts. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Have a great day. I'm Diane Ring.